Hello and welcome to the Cycling Podcast. My name is Richard Moore and I'm with Daniel Freib.
Hi, Rich.
Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And we are somewhere new, Lionel. Where are we?
We're in a pub in Hackney. We're kind of getting ready for that frantic Tour de France search for a recording venue that isn't full of people. So we found a quiet pub on a Tuesday, isn't it? On a Tuesday afternoon in Hackney.
Hackney, home of a future Tour de France winner, of course. Good friend of the podcast, Theo Gegenhardt.
Future Tour de France winner. Wow, that's quite a bold prediction, Daniel. You wouldn't catch me making bold predictions.
The Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
We're here, I suppose, as well, because we're launching the Cycling Anthology Volume 4 this evening locally in Look Mum No Hands. So we've got a packed show again today. We're going to talk again about Chris Froome and Bradley Wiggins, because we did discuss that last week, and Wiggins' possible omission from the Tour de France, which we all were fairly sure was going to happen. And lo and behold, a couple of days later, Bradley Wiggins, upon listening to the podcast, went on BBC, various channels on BBC TV and radio, did a tour of the BBC instead of a Tour de France, and said that, as things stand, he didn't think he was going to ride the tour. I think he was basically told last week that it probably wasn't going to happen. And he then took matters into his own hands and, to use a popular expression, tried to control the narrative, and did so fairly successfully. I think he emerged from that with quite a few PR points, if nothing else. We'll talk about Wiggins and Froome and whether or not Wiggins will, or what will happen with Wiggins over the next few weeks in part two. I think in part one we'll start talking about the race that's ongoing, the Critérium du Dauphiné, which began at the weekend with Chris Froome winning the prologue time trial and also winning stage one, the mountaintop finish, and really showing that he is in tour winning form, I think. Lionel, did you watch the mountaintop finish? A bit of a duel between him and Alberto Contador. What did you think of it?
Well, it was like looking into the future, the third week of the Tour de France, with Chris Froome trying to lay down his cards, really, to Alberto Contador. There was absolutely no attempt to hide his form. There was no attempt to kind of lull anyone into a false sense of security. He was very aggressive. He made several searing attacks, which really a very unusual style of riding, that's for sure. I mean, it's not aesthetically pleasing watch, is it? It's the way he accelerates in the saddle, his upper body all over the place, brings to mind a phrase about Jim Furyk's golf swing, which somebody once described as like an octopus stuck in a phone box, which
frog in a blender. No, you're right, actually. Jim Furyk, I can't remember who it was. Who's the frog in a blender? That might have been Furyk as well. Anyway.
Well, so Chris Froome is an octopus in a blender.
There were some good ones, weren't there, during the tour last year? Some good descriptions of Froome's riding style. I think there was an octopus pushing a shopping trolley was a good one. A daddy long legs on a pogo stick.
It ain't pleasant, but it is pretty effective.
And Contador looked like he didn't want to get drawn into anything. He certainly didn't, and didn't look like he was going to try and counterattack Froome. But he didn't look in any kind of difficulty. He looked like he was hanging on there pretty well, in contrast to some of the others, Vincenzo Nibali particularly.
It was a tough climb. It looked like a kind of really dead roads. You know, it was quite a featureless climb. I don't know if you know the climb, Daniel. You know most climbs, but it was an odd sort of dead climb, much steeper than I think it looked. It didn't have too many hairpins to break things up a bit and alter your rhythm. It looked like just a grind, and the sort of climb that if you're going well on, you can really make other people suffer. Contador wasn't as zippy as we've seen him at his best.
You don't think? I mean,
he was pushing a big gear. You know, he looked strong, but not without.
I think Froome is riding at a level that we've not seen before. I mean, I spoke to the Française des Jeux, the FDJ coach, Fred Grapp, this morning about it. And Fred Grapp is someone who takes a keen interest in the sort of wattages that people are putting out, and he sort of follows the debate that inevitably plays out on Twitter after stages like this very closely. And he said that Froome's performance yesterday, I mean, it really is approaching sort of the levels of Armstrong at his best without casting aspersions on how it's been achieved. He certainly wasn't insinuating that there was anything untoward going on. But Fred said that, two factors will basically determine performance, and this was something that was talked about yesterday on Twitter. I think there were a few fairly inflamed discussions about this, and you know, one is VO2 max, which is basically the sort of efficiency of the cardiovascular system, and the second one is efficiency, which is how well a rider uses their cardiovascular machinery. And Fred said that Froome is at the very, very top level we've ever seen on both of those two counts at the moment, certainly on the basis of yesterday's performance.
And a point I made before, just because you ride as fast as Lance Armstrong doesn't mean that you're doping. Let's be quite clear about that. There is a sort of assumption that people make that a performance as impressive as Armstrong automatically means doping. It doesn't. But I wonder, the other sort of talking point from the stage was the Team Sky and riders who Froome, for all that he is clearly very strong, will need at the Tour. And there is this question over whether it'll be the 2012 Team Sky or the 2013 Team Sky. Richie Porte didn't look... there has been talk that he's been back to his best after a difficult season, blighted by illness, but he didn't. He dropped off fairly early on the climb. I think Danny Pate and Kirienka had done a good job all day. On the climb itself, Mikael Nieve, the Basque climber, was impressive, very impressive. But, you know, Froome was left isolated quite a long way from the summit.
But Froome needs mounted domestics. He needs support a lot less than Wiggins did in 2012, doesn't he? I mean, we've seen tours, even in recent years, we've talked about this recently, about how the importance of climbers and the quantity of climbers that you need for a successful Tour de France team tends to be overstated. I mean, remember Cadel Evans, when he won in 2011, was almost always isolated in the last 5-10 kilometres of climbs, and BMC had pretty much a classics lineup, and which concentrated on keeping him safe in the first week. And it'll be interesting to see what Dave Brailsford does. I mean, I think we've mentioned it before on the podcast. We had a long discussion with him midway through the tour last year, when he almost admitted that he perhaps weighted the team too much towards climbers, and that they were missing, you know, perhaps a Bernie Ice or a road captain who perhaps would have preempted the problems they had in the second stage in the Pyrenees, the stage to Bagnères de Bigorre, I think, won by Dan Martin.
He also, of course, as a climber, Froome wants those riders, wants his team to ride up climbs faster than Wiggins would have wanted, and that inevitably burns them up a bit quicker. I think yesterday, or at stage one of the Dauphiné, he was instructing them to ride hard, and you know, Nieve eventually was following instructions to ride very, very fast indeed. And you know, his last teammate Froome was confident that he could take it on that far from the finish, and he was right. But as you say, Lionel, it does set up a tantalising duel perhaps at the Tour between Contador and Froome. And one thought that occurred to me was sorrow that Nairo Quintana, we believe, is not riding the Tour. However, I've got a thought about that. And there's no, this is no, this is not a rumour. This is not a rumour. This is not based on anything that I've heard. I wonder, just looking at Quintana, what he's done this year, and the way, even the way that he rode the Giro, and he seemed to win it in, it's always difficult to win a Grand Tour, but he won it in relatively controlled fashion. And he's not been over-raced this year. And interestingly, he's not riding the Dauphiné, as some Giro riders are riding Dauphiné Tour Switzerland. Those guys won't be riding the Tour. I don't think Quintana's riding the Tour Switzerland. Pretty sure he isn't. So I just wonder if at the last minute, Movistar
are going to spring. What storyline does Carlos Betancourt come in?
That's another story. But Quintana, I wonder if Movistar at the last moment will spring him on the Tour. You know, put him in there. I know he's a young rider, and long term that might not be the perfect career plan. Daniel's shaking his head. Not going to happen.
Don't
a bet?
Yeah.
A live bet on air.
How much?
£50.
You don't understand.
No, not £50.
You don't understand betting.
I understand that if we bet £20, I understand that one of us gets £20 from the other.
Right, okay.
£20.
Okay.
Excellent. Betancourt.
Yeah, Betancourt has gone AWOL in Colombia. He's gone back to Colombia after his spring races. This is Carlos Betancourt, the AG2R rider, focusing his entire year around the Tour de France. Was due back in France end of last week or at the weekend. Hasn't come back to France. AG2R can't get hold of him. He needs to be in France in order to get his work visa sorted in time for the Tour de France and the trip to Yorkshire. And yeah, as we speak at the moment, his whereabouts are a mystery.
WADA should know, shouldn't they? Hopefully they will know where he is. You would think.
He's in Italy or Denmark or Mexico with Michael Rasmussen.
No, Lionel. I should add, Daniel sort of alluded to, he rolled his eyes when I came out with a rumour. I should add a clarification to last week's breaking news about Geraint Thomas. I may have been slightly misled in saying that Geraint Thomas was going to leave Team Sky at the end of this year. I understand that he has now agreed terms and a contract has been prepared.
Oh my God.
He has not signed. He has not signed the contract yet, but I think that the chances are he will stay with Team Sky. And I wonder if some of the
180-degree turn you've done there.
I wonder if some of the rumours that were circulating were part of sort of battle to raise his salary a little bit.
Rumours perpetuated by you. We're going to make this a regular feature.
We're
going to make this a regular feature during the Tour de France. Rich's rumours, more sources. It made me laugh, Rich, when you said on Twitter when you told someone it's only a bit of fun. You know, it's not as though team sponsorship depends on it or anything like that. I think you did say it was only a bit of fun.
Well, it is a bit of fun.
This is nothing new. I mean, you know, football journalists kind of get used by agents and all sorts of other interested parties. If you can get a rumour placed on a very authoritative medium such as a cycling podcast, to help negotiate up the fee, why not?
That'll be 10%, please. So, as I say, Quintana for the Tour, you heard it here first.
This is the Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
So we're going to carry on talking about the Dauphiné a little bit because there are other contenders. The Dauphiné really is where most of the guys who will ride the Tour and we expect to challenge in the Tour are. You know, other riders like Bradley Wiggins are off to ride Tour of Switzerland. But there were others that we saw on that climb at the end of Stage 1 when Froome really lit the touch paper, starting to struggle. TJ Van Garderen, Vincenzo Nibali was clawing his way back, getting dropped again, clawing his way back. He couldn't match the explosiveness, the attacks of Froome, and you know when Contador could. And there's been some sort of news in the last week in Gazzetta dello Sport, which no doubt came from our good friend Ciro Scognamiglio, where Alexander Vinokourov, the team boss at Astana, has apparently write to Nibali expressing his unhappiness at his form so far this year. But Daniel, do you have any insight into this?
I mean, I think Vinokourov has been dissatisfied pretty much since the start of the season. They've not, up until the Giro and Aru's sort of breakthrough performance there, they've not had a very good season. And there have been various problems. There have been problems between Giuseppe Martinelli, who is the Italian director sportif, famously director sportif of Damiano Cunego and Marco Pantani in the past, now pretty much looks after Nibali. There were a few minor arguments between Martinelli and Nibali at Paris-Nice and then also at the Tour of Romandy about tactics. And Martinelli himself was coming under pressure from Vinokourov because the team wasn't winning enough races. I was pretty shocked. Nibali has not had a bad season. I mean, he's not won races, but he's performed pretty much, you know, up to the standard you would expect. Yesterday, I must admit, I think he looked completely outclassed. I mean, it's kind of been billed as a three-way fight for the Tour title. And he rode a decent prologue at the weekend on Sunday, but yesterday, although he managed to claw his way back a lot of the time, it tended to be when it kind of stagnated at the front. The pace had gone, and he made it back to the front, but he really looked a long way short of Contador and Froome standard.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't look as good as even Andrew Talansky and Jürgen Vandenbroek, who's kind of coming back after, you know, 2012. He would have been a big, big factor in that race had he not had the problem at the bottom of La Planche de Belfie. Was it his chain came off, I think, when Sky were on the front? And he had a good Tour, but he would have been a much bigger factor. So I expect him to continue this upward curve in form, and I think he's likely to be one of the top five kind of contenders. But Nibali is kind of, you never, apart from in last year's Giro where he really didn't have any kind of opposition, I've never really seen, can't really recall seeing him under tremendous pressure to be in the mix like he was on Monday's stage of the Dauphiné. And the first time I've really seen him in that situation, and he's not been able to keep up with Froome and Contador. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, particularly with Vinokourov's kind of old school management style. I'm never terribly sure whether threatening people and kind of, you know, making it publicly known that you're not hitting the mark. I'm not necessarily sure whether that's going to be a motivating factor or a disincentive.
Well, what's interesting is that Vinokourov didn't make it public, did he? The letter, the news of the letter appeared in Gazeta.
So it's Chiro's fault.
Chiro is basically, I was shocked watching that end of stage one of the Dauphiné to see Nibali and Chiro not on his wheel. You know, to see Nibali without Chiro beside
running,
him.
Running on beside him in a mankini.
alongside him in a mankini. But just see Nibali without Chiro this year is extremely unusual. But the publication of that letter, the news of that letter, presumably won't have helped relations between them.
Yeah, but if you put it into writing as a letter, then you run the risk of it being leaked. If you just have a conversation and a kind of an arm around the shoulder, I can't...
Only if Nibali himself allows it to be leaked.
Yeah, true. So
unless Chiro is intercepting his mail.
I would imagine Chiro's probably intercepting his mail.
I think that's very likely indeed, yeah. There we have the answer then.
But the point I'm making is, if in man management, if you have a conversation with somebody face-to-face and you say, look, come on, Vincenzo, you need to buck up a bit here, that's a very different thing to actually putting your thoughts in writing, whether by email or... I can't imagine it was a formal letter with
Dear Vincenzo.
Yeah.
Somehow I doubt that Vinokourov has been, you know, between retirement and taking on his post as the manager of Astana, he's had a term at the Harvard School of Business studying management techniques. No.
Well, you would think maybe, I don't know, read Steve Peters' book, The Chimp Paradox, something like that, pick up a few tips.
Steve Peters, who is going to be on the England bench at the World Cup, apparently, in full England tracksuit, or, you know, kit. And, I mean, this is taking us on to the next part of the podcast a little bit, but I did think about Steve Peters in the last week or so, as we've talked about Wiggins and Froome and what's gone on there. Steve Peters has done some incredible work with Victoria Pendleton, Chris Hoy and others. And, you know, Victoria Pendleton would probably not have become an Olympic champion without Steve Peters. But it'd be very interesting to speak to him about Chris Froome and Bradley Wiggins and the man management that's gone on there, and a failure, I suppose, to get those two somehow reconciled or at least able to function in the same team together. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, Steve Peters is a psychiatrist, isn't he? British Cycling and then Team Sky. And was he not kind of fundamental when Bradley Wiggins had his minor behind-the-scenes meltdown in 2012? Did Steve Peters not get involved in that? And when Wiggins kind of threatened to go home, when in the yellow jersey, it was Steve Peters who
possibly
talked to him?
He certainly spoke to him a lot in 2010. I remember they were Skyping every day at the Tour 2010. So he had a big role with Wiggins then, and I don't know what's happening. I mean, his role with British Cycling, with Team Sky, has reduced over time as he's been sort of more in demand elsewhere. He's been working with Liverpool Football Club, Ronnie O'Sullivan, lots of other sports people. Now he's very involved in also UK Athletics, actually, and the England football team. Anything more to say about the Dauphiné before we go into Froome and Wiggins?
No, just that, as you mentioned, I think, Rich, Van Garderen is a concern. Well off the pace yesterday. I suppose from Sky's point of view, Port is a bit of a concern. And Kelderman, we didn't expect to see as strong as he was yesterday.
He's come out of the Giro very well, hasn't he? Yeah. He's 24. Looks a real prospect for the future.
Yeah, I mean, the Dutch obviously are still looking for their first Tour winner since Zoetemelk in 1980, I think. I don't think they've necessarily got one in Kelderman, but someone who could definitely finish in the top five in future. Sort of, they tend to produce these... I mean, the old Rabobank under 23 system is interesting in that it produced a lot of riders who performed very, very well early in their career. And Robert Haysink was a good example. Bauke Mollema was another. And never really progressed hugely, having burst onto the scene 22, 23, 24, and clearly already very, very mature when they turned pro and very good, and perhaps with limited margin for improvement. That certainly has been the case thus far, but Kelderman might be an exception to the rule.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at @cycling_podcast.
Okay, let's revisit Chris Froome, Bradley Wiggins, a story that is still evolving, I think. as I mentioned at the start of the podcast, Lionel Bradley Wiggins went on.
We're easily confused, obviously, with my one tour win. You know,
it's an easy mistake to make. Bradley Wiggins went on the BBC last week. He gave an interview to Lee Keep and went on the BBC. I understand he was told on the Tuesday that he basically wouldn't be riding the tour. He then took matters into his own hands, and on Thursday morning, he was all over the BBC, on the breakfast couch, on Radio 5, on Radio 4, various outlets, and basically the message in every interview he gave was consistent, almost word for word. As things stand, I won't be riding the tour. It's a team sport. I understand that. I'm gutted. I'm deeply disappointed, etc., etc. And he's basically riding the Tour of Switzerland, but he's basically been put on a track program leading up to the Commonwealth Games. I wonder if Team Sky weren't sure about his real desire to ride the tour and whether he'd actually be quite happy to go to the Commonwealth Games. It appears not. And there seems to be a very real possibility that he might leave Team Sky. Now, I mean, he is out of contract at the end of the year. We have assumed that he would carry on until Rio and then probably retire after the Olympic Games there. But there seems a very real possibility now that he could leave Team Sky to try and ride the Tour de France again.
Yeah, I think leaving Team Sky, I don't think that's necessarily a surprise. That's been bubbling away for a number of months. In fact, since last year, when he missed the tour, there's been rumours that Orica Greenedge would take him at the click of the fingers. But what was interesting about several things were interesting about the way Wiggins kind of got on the front foot and went to the BBC, which, without getting into the conspiracy theories about Sky and Sky's role, not just in cycling but also in broadcasting, it was interesting that 99% of messages about Team Sky come through official channels, either from the team itself or through Sky Sports News. And there was Wiggins sat on the BBC breakfast sofa making a huge announcement. And I mean, without
not
being
wearing any branded clothing, which is quite unusual.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not party to his contract, but often there's perhaps not in an interview situation like that, but certainly a lot of TV interviews, a rider would be required to wear their sponsored kit, sponsored tracksuit or something. So it was definitely an attempt to kind of blindside Sky. Whether Sky knew he was going to do that, I can only assume they didn't. But just in terms of what it means for cycling and cycling in the UK, I think back to 2006, and I spent a few days with Wiggins when he was with Cofidis at the 4 days of Dunkirk, and he was, I think, that was the first year he rode the tour, wasn't it, 2006, mm-hmm. for Cofidis, yeah. And he was in the kind of limbo land of not knowing whether or not he would get selected for that tour, and the 4 days of Dunkirk was kind of like, you know, one of those races where Cofidis were whittling down the team heading towards the start in Strasbourg, I think it was that year, and there was a prologue time trial there, and I think he won the time trial in the Dauphiné, the prologue in the Dauphiné, and that pretty much secured his place. Anyway, going back to the 4 days of Dunkirk, we sat down a couple of times during that week, very informally, back in the days when, he was very relaxed. And
back
Wayne,
in the days when he was very relaxed.
Well, he was very relaxed around journalists. He wasn't the big story. He wasn't, he wasn't a huge player in the sport. And Wayne Rooney had just broken his metatarsal, and it was all over the media. And I remember just sort of throwaway line, just saying, have you got an opinion on Wayne Rooney's foot? And he was like, well, not really. I can't quite get my head around being the centre of a storm, a story of that kind of, where it's absolutely everywhere. Everyone is talking about a broken bone in your foot. Now, this isn't obviously an injury. This is a potential situation where Wiggins won't get picked for the team. And it's not on the same level, but it certainly shows how far cycling has come in this country, that ordinary people, I was in a WH Smith in Birmingham, and I was buying a cycling magazine at the end of last week, and the guy on the counter said, oh, what about Bradley Wiggins, eh?
Which one? Which cycling magazine?
Pro Cycling, actually, Daniel. I don't wish to flatter you there.
Any good articles in there this month?
It's still in the car. I haven't actually managed to open it, unfortunately. Sorry about that. So people have kind of really latched onto this. And if you talk to people who are either a little bit into cycling or have no idea about it, But just kind of it passes by them a bit at Tour de France time, in the same way that Wimbledon passes by people at the end of June. The British public are going to struggle to get their heads around, why is Bradley Wiggins not there? And on Twitter, although it's often a terrible barometer of public opinion, sometimes it can be a good indicator of how people are feeling. There is a fair amount of disappointment out there that, you know,
invective towards there is Sky staff. In fact,
exactly, people talking about we should go up to Yorkshire and paint Where's Wigger all over the roads, or I was going to take my lad up to watch the tour, but now Wiggins isn't there, I'm not going to bother.
You are quoting people here, Lionel.
Yeah, I'm quoting people here. I'm not talking about I haven't bought a load of paint to go and start daubing on the roads. But it's from my point of view, sort of having followed cycling for so long and seen it come from almost nowhere to this point where it's now a major talking point, and it's on the news. It was on the BBC news bulletin that Bradley Wiggins is not going to ride the Tour de France. It is extraordinary.
They handed them the scoop on a silver platter, didn't they? So yeah, I think they could probably made even more of it, to be perfectly honest. It was a story, and is a story, that has captured people's imagination for better or worse. And yeah, it's interesting. There is a situation here where Great Britain has the defending Tour champion Chris Froome, and there's a real disconnect between him and the public here, and they have really taken Bradley Wiggins to their hearts. I'm generalizing here, but there is a real significant body of support for Wiggins out there that there isn't for Froome. And you wonder about how that will play with the people who are at the team presentation, for example, out on the road. Froome is, he's been dealt an unfortunate hand in a lot of ways, coming along and appearing to be so dominant, for the first sort of really dominant stage race rider since Lance Armstrong, and also sort of stepping into the shoes of the beloved Bradley Wiggins. It's a hard thing to do. It doesn't seem to have affected his performance at all, which I think hints at just how tough a character he is. But
One thing I was going to say, talking about performance, looking at that stage in the Dauphiné on Monday, Wiggins wouldn't have been in that group, would he? If he'd been riding to team orders, he would have been perhaps the man before Mikel Nieve. So we would have seen kind of how he would be used in the Sky team, and so. But it is just about his presence in the race. Bradley Wiggins being here when the Tour starts in Yorkshire.
He might have lasted longer than Richie Port, and if he goes to Switzerland and rides well there, rides strongly, then do they revisit that? And if there's a problem with Richie Port, do they look at it again? It's still, and we should mention as well that Dave Brailsford gave an interview to the Sunday Times at the weekend, where he said, I'm in charge. Chris Froome doesn't pick the team. The riders don't pick the team. I will pick the team, and nothing has been decided yet, he said. There's still perhaps a way in for Bradley Wiggins. I spoke to David Walsh last week, who's obviously ghostwritten Chris Froome's book, and I said, does this not reflect badly on Team Sky's management of the thing I mentioned earlier in relation to Froome and Wiggins and their relationship, which is clearly very bad and has been since the Vuelta in 2011. And he said, to be honest, I think it's unmanageable. I think that, and you see that in some sports teams, there comes a point where somebody just has to go. We saw it, I hate to mention football, but at Manchester United, Alex Ferguson famously, no matter how good a player was, Jaap Stam or Roy Keane, if they were causing disharmony or even threatening to cause disharmony in the group, they were out the door.
You mentioned there Chris Froome's book, and you've read it, Rich. I mean, I've seen the reaction that people don't seem to be taking from that Chris Froome is a particularly warm character. Is that the impression you took from it?
Yeah, there is a sort of almost ruthlessness to him. Certainly a single-minded ambition, going right back to childhood. It's interesting, he went off to boarding school in South Africa quite as a teenager, and had quite a tough time at the first school he was at, and the second school was a little bit of a more friendlier sort of environment. And There's a fascinating story about him becoming a sort of bootlegger for his fellow pupils, because he was given a, because he was showing an interest in cycling and he was actually encouraged to ride his bike and go out training, he would go out and buy alcohol and cigarettes for his fellow pupils who weren't really allowed out the school so easily, and bring them back and sell them for a handy profit, which eventually enabled him to buy his first proper racing bike. An interesting little insight into Froome's sort of street smarts, if you like, which is not something you necessarily associate him with. Similarly, some of the stories of him riding for Kenya, it also actually puts his decision to switch from Kenya to Great Britain in a whole new perspective, because you realise that it was a quite a tough decision, one that his mother was against him making. She felt strongly that he should ride for Kenya. But some of the treatment they got from the Kenyan officials was pretty bad, and there was a real sort of amateurism at play there. Some amazing stories actually about, you know, Tour of Egypt, when a Kenyan rider abandoned the race and waited at the side of the road for the team car. The team car never turned up. It was in the middle of the desert. He eventually dug a little hole, a little shallow grave in the desert to try and get out the blazing sun. And the team manager appeared eventually that evening with photographs of the pyramids. He'd been off sightseeing. Mm-hmm. So he just ducked out the race, gone off sightseeing. Meanwhile, this rider had been left in the middle of the desert. Fortunately, a Polish soigneur came across him and saved him, and perhaps saved his life. It's full of...
Every good cycling story always features a Polish soigneur, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It's full of remarkable stories like that. And you realise he has had a pretty unusual, remarkable life. But yeah, I've read some reaction to it where people have not really warmed to him as a consequence of reading it. And I think a lot of that perhaps is people who are maybe Bradley Wiggins fans, and that whole episode, 2011 Vuelta, 2012 Tour de France, is one that I think people still do struggle to get their heads around. They, for all that Froome explains where he's coming from, what his motivations were, they do feel that he was not following team orders.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with I always think back to last year's tour. I remember there was a day, I can't remember, it was certainly in the third week, I can't remember which day it was, but I was stood in the mix zone where the yellow jersey has to go along the line and do interview after interview after interview with the rights holders for the Tour de France, the TV companies. And I kind of moved along with the crowd as people were kind of craning to hear what he was saying to the TV stations, and one after the other, he pretty much said the same thing. It wasn't very exciting stuff. It was all just, yeah, it was a tough day. We knew it would be a tough day. The team did great. There was just nothing. There was absolutely nothing. And TV kind of is your opportunity to project to the world a bit of your personality. And I thought throughout the tour last year, and I can only say this from a position of somebody who's never had to do that, it must be pretty daunting.
Didn't you just say you'd
won
the tour?
Oh yeah, well, I don't like to talk about it, but not having been in that situation where you have to face TV camera after TV camera and then go into that funny truck and do the two-way interview. There's for those who obviously don't cover the tour, there's a truck for post-race interviews where the stage winner and the yellow jersey go in one after the other. There's maybe, couple of dozen journalists can get into there. It's relayed then to the press room where there's, you know, 600-800 journalists. Two-way video and audio. It's a very unnatural thing. And it's just something the riders have to go through to kind of tick off they've done that, and then their recovery and the rest of their day carries on. But in terms of telling a story, in terms of kind of understanding who Chris Froome was, when you've got a situation where there's two or three questions, there's no opportunity for follow-up, so question one might be completely different to question two and so on. There's never any real chance to get into who Chris Froome actually is, and I felt like we got to the end of the tour and we hadn't scratched the surface of his personality. And Ned Bolting, who had spent a lot more time around Chris Froome than we had because he was working with ITV and doing a lot of the one-to-one interviews with Froome, he wrote a piece for Volume 3 of the Cycling Anthology in which the basic question was, who is Chris Froome? And after 3 weeks, he wasn't any clearer about his personality. And I get the feeling, not that I haven't read all of the climb yet, which is Chris Froome's autobiography, I wonder whether much of his personality is going to come across. And I think that's where the disconnect is. Bradley Wiggins wears his heart on his sleeve. He says things that capture the imagination a bit. He's just got a magnetic personality. So is Mark Cavendish. And Chris Froome just doesn't.
Yeah, and yet one of the accusations that Froome levels at Wiggins in a way is that he, in the team environment, he's a very gifted mimic. He can impersonate everybody, including Chris Froome, in a very strong and exaggerated South African accent, which he plays. He quotes a bit of that and says it is very, very funny. But all these things are sort of disguise. I mean, probably the when Wiggins does reveal himself is in these quite unnatural situations, oddly enough, where he's sitting in front of a bunch of journalists and he will say things that just do hint at who he is. In the team environment, he's quite introspective, quite shy, quite closed, and he almost disguises himself behind the impersonations, impressions, even the different sort of hairstyles and fashions that he wears, I think, I've always thought. Daniel, you've been very quiet.
How many more weeks are we going to talk about this? Wiggins
and Froome. How many weeks rather till the tour?
It's true for Riley. I mean, every week, isn't it? What happened to our discussions about Roger De Vlaeminck, Lionel Richie?
Well, what have you got to tell us about Roger De Vlaeminck?
is Roger De Vlaeminck riding the tour this year, Daniel?
Roger De Vlaeminck, never used to enjoy the tour because he said that he couldn't last more than about a week without, a few cans of Coke. That was the way Roger used to unwind at the tour. He said that, people like Felicia Gimondi used to be on bread and water and probably a few other things every evening. Maximum professionalism. And I think Roger used to feel a little bit claustrophobic at the Tour de France. Never really was his cup of tea.
He wanted to get back to his llamas.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to talk about, Daniel? Anything else you want to get? Daniel told me a great story the other day, very loosely connected to the Tour de France King of the Mountains competition. Daniel, what was that again? It started
I'm
off.
I'm not helping you at all with this. I'm not helping you at all.
I think it was you said that I've got something. You were looking at your phone and you said, "Oh, I've got a really bizarre thing that I used to do. I'm not sure if I should tell you." And then you went ahead and told me. And I think it was the story was that your first ever girlfriend, I think her name was Lucy, is that correct? But she went by the sort of nickname Lucho. So she had
an email address that was, it was Lush.
Lush. So you stored her in your mobile phone as Lucho Herrera, which it was Luis Herrera, the Colombian King of the Mountains in the Tour de France in the mid-80s. And that started a trend whereby you do have this habit of storing people's names in your phone as cyclist names. I think, what's my name at the moment?
Eufemiano Fuentes, you are in my phone.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. But you started storing girlfriends' names in your phone as Tour de France, King of the Mountains.
I only had one girlfriend. Tour de France, King of the Mountains. I changed the name periodically, so she became... she started life as Lucho Herrera, and then she became Federica Bahamontes, then she became Charlie Gore... Lucy Van Imp, I think she was at one stage.
Did you ever get to Bernard Cole?
No, sadly not. We kind of knocked out the head before then.
Okay, well, I think we'll leave it on that quite surreal note.
Extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary stuff.
That's better than my revelation last week, I think. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
And Daniel, thank you.
Thanks for that, Rich. Really appreciate you revealing that.
The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.